This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to a new episode of Freedom Books, Flowers and the Moon, the podcast brought to you each week by the Times Literary Supplement. My name is Thea Lenarduzzi, and sitting in for Stig Abel today is Michael Caines, fresh from our bonus podcast debate on the importance or not of literary prizes, a commissioning editor with too many specialisms to mention here. Welcome to this small dark studio, Michael Caines.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be standing in for Lee Child, loving, shy and retiring
oh,
editor.
Oh dear, stop there.
We'll stop there. We don't have to go the whole way.
Would you say that one of your specialisms is the metaphysical poet?
In a manner. I mean, I like the whole debate around them. It's a Johnsonian label, isn't it? And I think he borrows the idea from Dryden. And he uses it to beat poets with of the previous century. He doesn't quite agree with. I really like that idea that they're bound into a club by Johnson.
Yeah, well, I'm taking that as a yes.
I call that a yes because I do like the poets themselves. But the label itself, I like. It sort of tickles me.
Okay, well, we do. This is a seamless segue, I think you'll agree. We have a few new reviews, you see. And so thanks to everyone who's left them so far. Jess Dunmore has given us a fine pastiche of Andrew Marvell's most famous poem, which I'm hoping, Michael, you'll oblige us by reading in your finest 17th century tones.
Okay, well, that's my only tone.
So of course.
What other time is there? Don't wake me up from my time capsule. This is by Jess Dunmore, then.
Had I but world enough and time, this TLS obsession were no crime. I could sit with my cup of tea, my cat, and usually biscuits three. Through the paper I would peruse, full of articles to choose, slowly indulge in each one till the entire paper was done. This podcast, for 1,000 years I could listen, and ne'er my ears would grow tired of these debates, for which each week I eagerly await. But at my back I always hear the threat of A-levels hurrying near. Alas, I must return to work and resist such a fabulous podcast.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Jess. Thank you, Michael. I think that sort of beats Lucy Dallas's limerick, don't tell her.
I wouldn't dream of it.
Coming up on the show this week, what do you think would be the realisation, asked Charles Dickens, of one of my most cherished daydreams? The answer was to hold supreme authority in the direction of a great theatre, where the plays and the players would be absolutely under my control. Robert Douglas Fairhurst has been leafing through a two-volume collection of Dickensian stage adaptations, in which the great writer was, sometimes a little, sometimes, much to his chagrin, not at all in command. And are we hardwired to feel other people's pain? And if so, is it necessarily a good thing? Andrew Scull has reviewed 3 new studies of empathy and will join us to tell us more.
Charles Dickens, actor. Charles Dickens, playwright. Not all authors are necessarily great performers of their own work or lovers of strutting about on a stage, but Charles Dickens relished the theatrical side of life all his life, from precociously producing a tragedy at the age of 6, to playing the hero of The Frozen Deep by Wilkie Collins in 1857, to the famous series of public readings which began the following year. And Dickens didn't just write about the theatre in his novels, he wrote through the theatre. As Robert Douglas Fairhurst points out in this week's TLS, in a review of two volumes of Dickensian dramas, 19th century adaptations of his work, Dickens's innate theatricality enabled him to write, and the theatre world of the time, in a sense, was to return the compliment. Robert, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Let's start with the man himself. How important was the stage and mimicry, performance, imitation to the great Inimitable himself?
Oh, hugely important. So he attended hundreds of productions. He thought about becoming a professional actor. He made friends with William McCready. He loved amateur dramatics. He loved the idea of drilling people like a drill sergeant to make them do his bidding on the stage. And after he abandons the idea of being an actor, he still kept one foot in that world, though. So his clothes, like those brightly coloured waistcoats he loved, were a little bit like a costume that he could use to go out into the world in. He liked catchphrases like Grimaldi the Clown's "Here we are," which was supposedly the first thing he said when he stepped onto American soil for the first time. But also he deflected drama into his own fictional writing. So his daughter, Mamie Dickens, and I talk about this in my review, that she saw him once in the throes of composition. And it was like a kind of one-man show. He would get up from his writing. He would stare into the mirror, gesticulating and mouthing the words. And then he would go and scribble things down. So it was as if he was turning the mirror into a kind of page. The page became a kind of stage for him.
And his reading performances, his great transatlantic tours, they presumably allowed him to flex those muscles further.
Oh, absolutely, yes. And what's interesting is that this is a side of him which people think they know about because of collections like Philip Collins's edition of the Public Readings, and because critics like Edmund Wilson said that he was the greatest dramatic writer the English have known since Shakespeare, which is, you know, quite a claim. Especially when you look at his own plays, which were pretty thin, the ones he wrote early in his career, pretty thin farces. But yes, it was things like the Public Readings which really showed how his fiction was dramatic and it was theatrical. It was actually quite stagey. You've got characters who seem to be making speeches, not just talking to each other. You've got bits of narrative that drift into a kind of sub-Shakespearean blank verse whenever he reaches moments of extreme pathos, like the death of Little Nell or the death of Joe in Bleak House. You've got illustrations that look as if the characters are actors. They're sort of freezing into theatrical tableau. But the reason this addition is so important, I think, Dickensian dramas is it's the first time that anyone has looked really closely at the plays that people wrote in response to his fiction. So you've got his 16 plays, two big volumes, 50 years worth of theatre. Starts in 1837 and goes up to 1887. But also it shows just how closely involved Dickens himself was with the whole enterprise of turning his novels into plays.
And what are these dramas themselves? I mean, what are they like? Is there a consistent attitude portrayed by them? Did it change greatly over those 50 years?
Well, it's interesting. They're patchy in terms of quality. I suppose what they remind us of, and this is something they do all have in common, is just how obsessed Dickens himself was with deceit and disguise, and secrets coming to light, all of which, of course, are very theatrical ideas, and all of which these plays do rummage around in interesting ways. Where they're not successful is, in fact, where they ignore the way that the page and the stage differ. So where they simply transfer across the narrator's words and put them in the mouths of characters, they make the character sound a bit feeble-minded.
May I drastically lower the tone by asking if you both have favourite adaptations of Dickens?
Well, actually, if you're thinking about more recent adaptations, I mean, for us, of course, it's not theatre, it's film, isn't it? It's TV. And the editors here point out that there are, you know, 64 versions of A Christmas Carol alone, and they say that, you know, these star the Muppets and the Smurfs and the Flintstones and Barbie and a load of dogs. Actually, my favourite adaptation, I think the one that is most Dickensian, is The Muppet Christmas Carol.
Yes.
I think that, the arts editor here would agree with you.
That is the adaptation which gets closest to Dickens's grotesquery and that fine line between comedy and pathos, and the fact that the people often aren't like people. They often seem to be more like sort of grotesques in disguise.
What do you make of the film, the 1968 film? So it's its 50th anniversary now. That was an adaptation itself of the Lionel Bart musical from 1960. Have you seen it recently?
Of Oliver?
Yeah, of Oliver.
Yes, I have seen it recently, and in fact, the word on the street is there's going to be a remake of it.
Ooh. A reverend.
I probably shouldn't
say more than that, but I think they're still trying to get the money together, but there are moves for a remake, which will be interesting. I think Oliver, the film, is fascinating because it tries very, very hard to get what Dickens called in that novel the streaky bacon effect of melodrama sort of interrupted by moments of farce. And I think it largely succeeds. The one thing that perhaps doesn't succeed, oddly, in a musical is the music.
Well, and Mark Lester himself, who played Oliver, I learnt recently, wasn't even singing. His singing parts were dubbed by the daughter of Johnny Green, who was doing the music for the film.
Yes, and it's interesting they chose someone who couldn't really sing to play the role of the hero, isn't it? And not just Lester, but in fact the voice that they then dubbed onto his rather plaintive, pathetic little face itself isn't a very, very strong voice. So what, perhaps one of the odd things about that film is you've got old stagehands, old kind of troopers like Rod Moody, who knows absolutely how to hit the back of the stalls, mixed up with, yes, these rather kind of thin and rather plaintive voices, as if you've got lots of different musicals all kind of fighting for space on the same screen.
I wonder, that brings us in a way, I'm not trying to raise the tone, I'm resolutely staying low here, just because as you mentioned, this potential remake, there's something you mentioned in your review about people delighting in just having the pleasures of the novels put on stage and no surprises, just repeating things in a way. It's sort of comforting and consoling, I suppose. And it's why we do see, I suppose, endless cinematic remakes and happy restagings of the same plays after a given period. I suppose these Dickensian adaptations trying to deliver the same thrills, as it were, to the audience that they'd expect, that they know about from the serialised novels.
I think that's right. The reason that the novels appeal first of all to people who wanted to go along to these early stage versions, often in fact so early that they were coming out when the novels were only halfway through. You know, Dickens himself often didn't know how he was going to end his novels when these pirated versions were being put on stage in places like London. But the reason they appeal to people is partly because, well, it's a matter of fashion, because there were strong characters, the stories were pulling people along, but also, yeah, familiarity. You would go along and see a stage version of Sam Weller because it was like going visiting an old friend. You already knew some of his catchphrases, so it's a little bit like watching Little Britain. You know, you chant along to the catchphrases and feel like you're part of a gang, part of the in crowd. In fact, Dickens himself says in his preface to Bleak House, he says in that novel, he says, "I've purposely dwelt on the romantic side of familiar things." And I suppose for Dickens, that was the appeal of the theatre. It also showed the romantic side of familiar things.
I know you mentioned Macready. I mean, he reviewed Macready's Lear maybe quite young and then saw pretty much his last performance as Lear. Is that about right? So these are plays that you get used to the idea that these are things you live with, and that's what Dickens is aspiring to create in his own work.
And I suppose the theatre, because the theatre is also a place of, well, for Dickens, a place of magical transformations. Pantomime for him was a place, he says, where nothing is but thinking makes it so. And I suppose for the audience as well, it was a way of taking what should be familiar and transforming it into a new idiom, a new style, a new range of expressions. So even the most familiar stories could be made strange.
I wonder if there's a case to be made afresh here for the significance of theatrical adaptations in the theatre more generally in literary history. We've recently had Frances Wilson writing in the TLS about Frankenstein, and in that she emphasised the vital role of a theatrical adaptation by Richard Brinsley Peake. Is the interplay there healthy? Is it important?
I think it is. And the reason that it's been disguised for so long, which the editors of these volumes point out, is that Dickens himself wanted to keep the whole thing at arm's length, even when he was involved. He wanted to keep up appearances as a serious novelist and not just a hack dramatist adapting his own work. But because there were so many real hacks, you know, thieves, opportunists, circling around his work and sticking it on the stage, that's when he decided, if you can't beat them, join them. And he became really closely involved in theatres like the Lyceum Theatre, which was just down the road from his offices at the Journal all the year round. And he would sit on a rehearsals and he would make suggestions. And he was often, he was like a silent partner in these productions. And that's why they're so important, because they are a whole new range of material that he had a hand in, which, because he was so successful in disguising his own part in them, we've largely ignored.
Thank you very much, Robert Douglas Fairhurst.
My pleasure.
I, for one, am very pleased to hear that Dickens was such a fan of amateur dramatics, because my first theatre experience was seeing my mother play Mrs. Sowerberry in an Amdram production of Oliver.
This is a new line in TLS editor confession. I can't remember my first Amdram production, but I was in The King and I, so I have definitely done that.
Oh, but you were in it, you weren't even watching it. You've already one-upped me.
And it's bad that it might as well have been, it was worse than it would have been. A good Dickens would have described it. Let's just leave it there. Dickens would have described it very well. There was much glaring,
it was
much
well
tramping
reviewed
across the stage. No, it wasn't. I hope it wasn't reviewed at all.
Well, in other news, this contribution to by Robert Douglas Fairhurst is bits, but one of many in a feast of Victoriana. I imagine you hate that word, so sorry. What else have we got to look forward to?
I'm delighted by it. This week's issue is copious and delights on the Victorian side of things. Not only do we have Dickens and the drama, but we have Thackeray, the journalist and skit writer for Punch. We have Hopkins and the religious experiences that inform his poetry, Thomas Hardy and architecture. We had Laura Ingalls Wilder, so just slightly outside, obviously, this side of the Atlantic. Laura Ingalls Wilder, and who really wrote some of the more incendiary sides of her books. And we have Victorian photography, to name just a few of the things in it. And there are things in there too. So it's a delightful feast. It's like a kind of mini Crystal Palace in waiting for anyone who wants to step back into the age.
But it's there, which Crystal
it's
Palace
there.
Is not.
That's
it's there.
The crucial difference. It's there. Let's hope it's in the newsagents, coming through your little box, etc.
And if that does not make our listeners want to go and pick up a copy, I don't know what will.
Roll up.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to one full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Empathy, this notion of being able to put oneself in someone else's shoes to, as Bill Clinton cringingly put it, feel your pain, seems to be attracting a great deal of scrutiny these days among academics as well as the general public. It's generally agreed that an abundance of empathy in a person, or indeed in a society as a whole, is a good thing, while an absence of it, termed an empathy deficit, is considered worrying. In the popular imagination, it's understood to be one of the signs that, along with insincerity, disregard for the facts and a rehearsed kind of charm, might indicate that a person is a psychopath. This does inevitably lead into politics, where voters might voice concern over a lack of empathy in leadership and international relations. Then again, other voters might think said leader is showing too much empathy, a sort of weakness. The ongoing refugee crisis is perhaps a case in point. As the blurb supplied by Barack Obama to accompany one of the books under review this week puts it, if we are going to meet the moral test of our times, then I think we're going to have to talk about the empathy deficit, the ability to put ourselves in somebody else's shoes, to see the world through somebody else's eyes, which, if we can hold off musing on the role of empathy in Obama's own time in office, leads to all sorts of questions, among them, what is empathy? How can we recognise it? Where does it come from? And is it always for the best? Andrew Scull, Professor of Sociology and Science Studies at the University of California, San Diego, joins us on the line to tell us more. Andrew, hello.
Hello, Thea.
Before we wade into all of this, do we need to make a distinction between sympathy and empathy? I know that empathy means, in the Greek at least, in feeling, while sympathy means with feeling. I wondered if it's a matter of degree of involvement.
To an extent, I think that's right. But, you know, very often these things overlap and get confused with one another. So in actual usage, I think they often tend to run together. But these books are really trying to, or at least one or two of them are trying to suggest that simply putting yourself in the other person's place makes a really big difference to how you behave. Paul Bloom argues that that isn't sufficient for the kinds of moral action we'd like to see. The book by Steve Sturman, by contrast, I think makes a great deal about the ability of people to see one another as fellow humans as marking a very important part of the moral evolution of human beings.
A large part of this field now of the history and study of the emotions, it's very much rooted in this new technology, which you mentioned at the very start of your piece, this new technology being the MRI scan. Why is this idea of being able to map empathy, or any emotion for that matter, why is it such a dangerous one?
Well, there's a tendency among some neuroscientists, by no means all, to try to reduce human beings to machines, I think, and to suggest we're all simply the creatures of the mechanical functions of our brain, and then to look at the images that are created, and in an important sense we need to understand they are created through measuring what is in fact blood flow in regions of the brain, and saying, see, here we can see somebody being angry, here we can see somebody being empathetic, here we can see somebody having romantic feelings towards someone else. But in fact, all we're seeing here are correlations as the brain morphs from one state to another. And the whole scientific basis of this strikes me as very shaky. We're not actually seeing our innermost thoughts and our character in these scans. These kinds of neuroscientific claims, I think, are quite dangerous. It's not really a very good way of going about understanding human consciousness. It kind of, as I say, reduces us as though we were machines. And it's very odd because these people argue with us and try to persuade us. But in fact, if they're claims were right, argument and persuasion would be quite useless.
And you certainly see that in the Peter Bazalgette book. This very much comes into play, this idea of being able to make general rules about, you know, this is what rage looks like, this is what empathy looks like. So they gloss over the individual nuance and the content of the thoughts. And then you tend to sort of, that tends to lead to this idea of internal hardwiring. We're all the same. And then
yes,
gender
exactly.
comes into it.
That we can somehow translate these images into content. And in fact, we don't have any way of making that kind of transition. This is not to say that functional MRIs haven't revealed interesting things about the way the brain is put together, but they don't really allow us to penetrate to the nature of human thought and human consciousness. And indeed, they tend to be used to try to dismiss those as fictions.
And Peter, this Bazalgette book, he's an interesting figure because he's certainly best known actually as a TV executive, a man who popularized the Big Brother TV format. So what exactly is his thesis here?
He's trying to explain, I think, how we might, for example, prevent various horrors. He alludes to the activities of people like Hitler, Stalin, and Mao, and says, well, these are people who are lacking their empathy instinct or who've lost their empathy instinct. He tries to explain human activities in terms of this instinct that's supposed to drive people either towards positive actions or in very strange directions. And the instinct sort of comes and goes at will. So when he wants to explain something, he'll say, well, that people switched off their empathy instincts, and that's how they were able to behave in this horrible fashion. So it's an attempt to explain the world via something he purports to have discovered in these scans. And it turns out this instinct is variably pleasant whenever he needs it and goes away whenever he wants it to disappear. It ends up explaining absolutely nothing.
And he thinks it's handed down genetically. Is there any truth in that?
But I think we're not able to tell that. It's just a set of claims about human nature that rests upon what I think is simply bad science.
Andrew, thinking more generally about empathy and the idea that empathy is a good thing, not just thinking about Bazalgette's account, but can we in fact trust it to guide our behaviour in the best direction?
Well, it is complicated. And I think Paul Bloom, who has this very provocative title of Against Empathy, points out the ways in which we tend to empathise with people like ourselves, people we can readily place ourselves in their shoes. And that can be quite dangerous because it also licenses a sort of xenophobia against those we don't extend that thing to. But Paul Bloom also makes some other points that I think are quite interesting. The ways in which a torturer who can empathize with the victim, that is, put himself or herself in the place of the person being tortured, is able to torture more effectively. And he cites 1984 as an example of that sort of thing. So empathy is something that often has its limits and, like anything else, needs to be put aside alongside other factors when we're deciding how we should behave. On the other hand, and I think this is where Bloom comes around, though we need to temper our emotional responses with some reason, it is important, you know, being able to understand the position of the other is in fact a rather important human characteristic, and its absence is potentially extremely unfortunate. And indeed, Stearman's Invention of Humanity places a great deal of emphasis, I think, at the end of the day, about on the development of this sense of links to other people, a sense of common humanity, something that he doesn't in any way suggest has developed in a linear fashion, but indeed has been a key to living together without violence and xenophobic hostility. But these are things Sturman suggests are a cultural creation. They are the result of human reflection, of the development of societies, not something that simply is hardwired in the brain.
Sort of more to use the Dread terminology, more a question of software, of cultural layering on top of whatever there is there originally. But this Sturman book that you mentioned, the Invention of Humanity, because he argues, as you said, that empathy has been sort of on the rise for centuries, or you know, legal manifestations of it and so on. Is the display of empathy that we see documented in that book, is it part and parcel of, you know, civilized societies realizing that they can in fact get more beneficial terms, you know, territory, trade deals or whatever, by cultivating a kind of like calculated caring?
I think it extends beyond simple calculation, although obviously that plays some part. But one of the things that Sturman points out is how partial always this is, and how halting the progress has been, and how sometimes it slips back, and how limited the sense of empathy, the ability to identify with the other. It's a very notion of a barbarian, as somebody sort of beyond the pale, plays an important role in his book, but it's not at all a simple story that he tells, or unlike the very simple position that Bazalgette tries to present. It's one that is a very alive to the complexities, I think, of how people have learned to stop treating the other as object and begin to see them as fellow humans, and the limits of how that is. When he's talking about the Enlightenment, for example, he's very alive to the limits of the sense of common humanity.
On a final note, and with this question of complexity in mind, really, is there a risk that technological advances now are in a sense curtailed by a desire to find simple answers, rules on which to set theories about how we are and how we should be? I'm wondering, is there an impulse to explain and so control our behaviour, individual and societal?
Well, then I'm sure there is such an impulse. I'm not at all convinced that it will triumph, fortunately. We are attracted to simplicities all the time in this territory. I think we see that in these books. One of them very, very simple, the other extremely complex, I think, and as a result, much less accessible. So it's always nice to be able to go back and explain human activity in a couple of quick strokes in terms of differences between male and female brains, for example, which is a topic Bazalgette moves into and I think makes a real mess of.
You can almost imagine, I think, Peter Bazalgette saying something like, you know, the goal we must set ourselves is to find a technology that enables us to switch on empathy in individuals who aren't manifesting it, and then the world will be a better place for our children.
Right. No, I think there's some of that coming through. I think that's an absolutely fruitless goal. I mean, but it sounds as though it's based on science, but in fact, it's distorting what science can in fact accomplish here.
Well, thank you, Andrew Scull. I think we'll have to leave it there. Thank you for your time.
Bye-bye.
That is it for this week. Many thanks to Andrew Scull, Robert Douglas Fairhurst, and of course the Marvellian Michael Caines. Do pick up or download a copy of the paper this week, or visit our website to read us there and subscribe. As well as the pieces we've just discussed, you'll find a fascinating essay by Barbara Ehrenreich on cancer and the troubling double agency of white blood cells, David Baddiel on humour and Nazi dogs, an account of the rise of the demi-democratic states of Southeastern Asia, and much more. Next week, I'll be back, as will Stig. For now, though, goodbye.
Hold up. Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.